This is Inside Douglas County on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN. It's our daily in-depth look at people and issues that are shaping the local area. Inside Douglas County is presented by Concrete Builder Supply. Now, Inside Douglas County on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
And today, a conversation with Matt Hill, Executive Director of the Douglas Timber Operators. Thanks for coming in.
Hey, Kyle. How's it going?
Well, a busy day, a lot going on, and kind of wanted to go in depth on this report that came out recently from your organization. You commissioned it with fire historian Bob Zyback, who is a PhD, which is just in itself rather fascinating. I'm not sure I'd ever heard the term fire historian before. Tell us a little bit about him, first of all.
Well, Bob's been around Western Oregon for decades and worked for many years in reforestation crews leading those efforts on private timberlands, I think some federal timberlands. And then when, you know, the politics of forest management shifted dramatically in the early 90s, he got pulled more into the policy direction, earned his PhD from OSU, started looking at fire history, and Dr. Zyback knows more about fire history in Western Oregon than anyone I've ever met. And so that's who we went to just kind of look at what's happening with fires here and then turning that into a look into the future to see what we can expect if we keep going down the current path.
So in this report that your organization commissioned, were you looking at our area or Western Oregon in general?
It was limited to really the Archie Creek fire from 2020, but Zyback pulled in, you know, his knowledge of larger patterns, historical, and then, you know, kind of flipped that into, you know, what will happen in this area in areas like the Archie Creek fire, but expanded it to the whole Umpqua National Forest and the Umpqua Basin.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, after Archie Creek, once we all got a grasp and a lot of people were able to go up there and even take just a highway view of things, and, you know, even with a basic layman's knowledge, you realize that you're not, you know, if you're alive now, you're likely to not ever see it quite the same way ever again, unless maybe you're super young. But not having all the professional knowledge and everything that, you know, comes from being in an industry or whatever, it seems like he went pretty deep into this.
He did, and there's a couple main takeaways that I think are, you know, they're common sense, but they also needed to be put down and analyzed and have some data behind it. You know, one thing is that if you grew up in this area, you don't remember there being large fires, and that's because there weren't until about 1987, and then we've had them increasingly so generally every year. This year was an anomaly in recent history. And so looking at, you know, why is that happening, and then what is the legacy of leaving massive amounts of dead wood on the ground? And when you see a forest fire or an area that's burned, you think, well, the forest burned and it's not going to re-burn again because it all got consumed in the fire, and that's just not accurate. It actually makes things worse for the future, because now you've got, unless it's removed and processed, you've got a lot of dead standing firewood that's actually more flammable and more dangerous when the second, third, and fourth fires come back.
Talk about some of the findings that he had. One was regarding just how much of the Umpqua National Forest is burned.
Yeah, he found that about 40% of the Umpqua National Forest has burned just in the last 20 years, depending on how you count it. Many areas have burned multiple times. So up Apple Creek, up Boulder Creek, Boulder Creek Wilderness Area, places like that. Same on the South Umpqua drainage, a massive amount of the Tiller Ranger District has burned or reburned, like something like 80% in the last 20 years. And you know, the same is true for BLM lands. I don't want to exclude them. They're the same phenomenon is happening there. And so, you know, unless you're driving deep into the woods or looking at a lot of these maps, you don't really understand the scale of what is happening and the cumulative effect of leaving all of this wood in place over time.
Yeah, and talk about that in terms of, you know, the snags. I mean, how many are remaining versus how many have gotten cleared out on private land?
Right. Well, let's take Archie Creek Fire, more or less evenly split between public and private ownership. Virtually all the snags on private, at least industrial timberlands, have been removed. New trees planted, and those sites will green up over time, and there's virtually no dead fuel left on the site, so the risk of reburn is minimal. On federal land, you know, roughly 1% of the dead snags are removed, and most of that is along roads. They're still clearing roadside snags on the Umpqua. BLM, I think, did a much more aggressive job clearing those sites along roads because they had to allow access for private timber landowners to gain entry to. But you're looking at 1% or less of that timber that is killed in the fire, removed and processed. So you're leaving the vast, vast majority of those dead trees standing.
So what does that do the next time you have a fire in that area?
Well, Zyback interviewed firefighters, both current, active and retired, and got their input on how leaving dead trees affects fire behavior and how you fight fire. It changes fire behavior. You've got a lot more dead wood that blows up. It rains sparks. It shoots embers miles ahead of the line of the fire, which causes spot fires, on the other side of your fire lines. Up in the Columbia River Gorge, we saw 10-foot snags blowing across the Columbia River and starting fires in Washington State. So it really changes fire behavior. It's more dangerous, and therefore it's harder to attack, which means that you may not be able to attack the fire in the same way you could if it was a green forest, and then that just creates more areas burned, more snags left, and it's a downward spiral that ends up converting our forest to some other type.
So when one of those fires comes along with the potential for it to really, flare up, if that's the right word, and really intensify there, is that in fact impact how a firefighter, somebody leading an effort, would want to go in and address it?
Absolutely. You're not going to send smoke jumpers into a snag patch. You're not going to send firefighters on foot under a snag patch because you've got falling trees, you've got falling embers. We had a fatality on one of the fires in this area this summer with someone affected by a falling tree. It's under investigation, but it's dangerous. And so you just don't do certain things out of an abundance of caution. And that will lead to more acres burned and more dead trees across the landscape.
So then how long does this risk remain?
It could be half a century or more. And what happens is the fire comes through, it burns the needles and fine vegetation in the area. The next fire comes through maybe 10, 15 years later, reburns that and all the brush that's grown up beneath these dead trees. And then it brushes up again with fewer and fewer conifers. And by the time the third fire comes, there's not much left of the tree. And what nature's doing is just clearing that site of fuel, which is the exact same thing we try to do on private timberlands after fires. Get rid of that fuel, stop the reburn cycle, and get that forest growing again much faster. And if you do nothing, it could take hundreds of years in some of these sites for a forest that you saw prior to the fire come back.
So do these reburn areas, can you end up with ultimately different vegetation?
Absolutely. If you go up to Fall Creek, Susan Creek, Boulder Creek, Apple Creek, Limpy Creek, any of these places up the North Umpqua where you've seen high intensity fire, no salvage, little or no reforestation, or in some cases reforestation where those seedlings were burned in the subsequent fire, you're looking at no living conifers, a site dominated by hot flashy fuels, grasses, and then you could get manzanita or brushes or invasive species, and so the conifer, Doug fir, cedar forest that was there is not there again, and that site is open, it's hot, it's a different type of site altogether. And the irony there is that many of these places were set aside to be old growth forests, to be lush, late successional reserves that are set aside from logging, but logging's not killing them, fire is, and I don't think our rules and regulations adequately address that.
Hey, you talked about the differentiation between the private land and some of the government lands as well, and obviously the land managers have got to follow what comes down from above.
Yeah, I mean, they are following the rules and regulations, laws, and threat of litigation that they have, and they don't have a lot of choice, and I don't think that they could have done much more after Archie Creek or some of these other fires than they did because of the set of rules and regulations they have. But I think those rules and regulations need to be reevaluated to address the threat of fire.
More with Matt Hill when we come back. The report is a growing sea of snags. We'll talk more about it. The interview, a podcast after one at 541radio.com. 1246 News Radio, 93.9 FM, 1240 KQEN. Inside Douglas County, 1248, Lars Larson at 1, True Wealth Radio at 4. Tomorrow we'll talk about the Umpqua Community College Foundation. Matt Hill, Executive Director of the Douglas Timber Operators, in today talking about the report they commissioned called A Growing Sea of Snags with fire historian Bob Zybach. You've had the report out for a while. Other than your organization, who is this report meant for to take a look at or to view?
Well, I provided an advance copy to local federal land managers and welcome their feedback and hope they at least take a look at it. None of the information there should come as a surprise to them, and I think some of them are as frustrated as anyone about the phenomenon of catastrophic fires. How to deal with them. You know, when a fire happens, their staff gets pulled into not only the suppression, but post-fire analysis, what's called the burned area emergency rehabilitation process, reforestation, dealing with burned bridges, burned roads, all that type of thing. So the recovery from these fires pulls federal land management staff off of their normal jobs into this recovery mode for years, and then they go back to what they're doing. But if you have big fires back to back, summer after summer, you're constantly sucked into that cycle, and it's really affecting the ability of these agencies to do their normal job, and they just get pulled into permanent fire detail.
And on the state level this year, and I think some of this came from some of the COVID-19, if you want to call them that, federal funds that came in. The legislature allocated a lot of additional money for different fire organizations to have more aggressive staffing levels. And even something this year with ODF and some of the other groups if they were really worried about a storm, pre-positioning people, having people ready there. And it looks like in some cases that kind of thing made a difference, but it obviously comes at a big financial cost.
It certainly does, and when you talk to DFPA here locally, they're responsible for fire management on both private timberlands and BLM. And I think something like 14% of just those lands are fire scars now. So they're seeing these areas starting to reburn. That changes how they fight fire. And as taxpayers, we pay for that as well as private forest landowners. And so those costs are increasing. They had a good year so far this year. Hopefully they're out of fire season officially.
I could say a bad pun like knock on wood, but right. That wouldn't be a good idea, so we won't do that. What about the recommendations coming out of this from Mr. Zybach? What did he feel like needed to be done?
He recommended more coordination between landowners and reforestation strategies. As one example, adding fire breaks across the landscape to be able to stop the spread of these large fires. One example of that is utilizing the significant road network, which was built by loggers and log buyers over the last 60 years on federal lands to access timber sale areas. Those are natural areas where you could do heavy thinning on both sides of the roads and create, you know, a vast network of fire breaks. So I'd like to have more conversation with the BLM and Forest Service about that, accessing federal funds for that, and just understanding what the long-term plan is. at the very least, of reducing the threat of these big fires, and then also how to respond to them afterwards in terms of reducing some of the wood across the landscape. And that's the big recommendation from ZIBAC, is you've got to change the cycle somehow. So either you remove more of the wood after the fire and get that forest growing faster, or you just dig in and prepare to deal with larger and larger fires. And that makes it more expensive. It's more risky for firefighters. It's more risky for landowners. It puts more people in harm's way. And I don't think that's a good option. And we should be talking more about how to change fire behavior and make these forests more resilient to fire when they happen.
Well, and this idea of big fire break areas that you just talked about, what popped into my mind instantly is that this is a much larger version of what DFPA harps on for just private folks about defensible space. This is sort of the ultimate defensible space concept.
It is, with one exception, which is in defensible space, you've got a home point, and then you thin around it. You know, when you're dealing with landscape fire, you don't know where a fire is going to strike. And so part of it is being strategic, understanding fire behavior, weather behavior, historic fire patterns, that type of thing. It's complex stuff, but it's not impossible. And there should be more conversation about doing it. There should be more federal funding coming here. You know, you look at the fire maps produced at national level by the Forest Service, the Umpqua doesn't land very high on the priority scale. Yet, you know, I think we're burning as bad, if not worse, than most other national forests in Oregon. So we need the help, we need management, and we need to be doing stuff on the ground.
One of the things here, and you sent me over some notes to look at today, one of the recommendations I'm curious if you can expand on was the aspect of replicating historic Indian burning practices.
Yeah, there's a lot more research coming out about what those practices look like. An OSU researcher recently took a bunch of tree core samples and looked at where the burn was. In some areas, there were annual fires, places where Indians would go annually. They'd burn it when they left, stimulating, you know, the growth of forage for deer and elk and berries and root vegetables that they were digging. Understanding how Indian people influenced this landscape before settlers came. This wasn't an isolated, you know, area with no people. There were people, and those people were active managers of the land. They consumed fuel for heat, for food, for other purposes, for security. And so understanding how, when those people were largely removed from this area, that changed how forests were growing. And then when we started, you know, large-scale suppression, that changed things as well. And we've got to find a way to get management in some way back onto the landscape so that it functions in a healthier way, because no one is winning under the scenario of mega fires. It is absolutely disastrous to wildlife. It's dangerous to humans. It's toxic to the air. It affects water quality and fish habitat. And it is the antithesis of what I consider conservation. And we are failing the environment by continuing down this path, and we've got to go a different direction.
And as you were talking about these native practices, even knowing that the Cow Creek tribe yesterday and today was doing a burn on some of their land.
I saw that press release. Kind of ironic. And you go up into areas up on the North Umpqua and South Umpqua, and there's large prairies and meadows, and those, many of them, are the result of repeated burning. Oak Flats, Ilhi, places, Tokadi, places like that. And there's evidence of that happening. And it also is antithetical to a lot of the conservation tools that have been placed upon the landscape, wilderness areas, places that are basically no touch, no management, along rivers, wild and scenic river corridors like the North Umpqua. We have created a management structure in which we want as much fuel and timber and growth to happen without it being touched by humans, yet that also poses major risks for catastrophic fires in the future. So I think we need to rethink some of those tools before putting them on the landscape.
People want to find out more. I know that this report probably goes more on a professional level. Is there anything that folks listening could access from your organization?
Yeah, if you go to dougtimber.org/ZYBAC, ZYBACH, the full report is there. And then if you do ZYBAC-report, you get the press release, which has a summary of it.
All right, Matt Hill from the Douglas Timber, our producer. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Kyle.
1257, News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
You've been listening to Inside Douglas County on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN. A daily look at the people and issues that are shaping Douglas County. It's presented by Concrete Builder Supply. The show will be available as a podcast in just a few minutes at 541radio.com. So share it around and let others who weren't listening live know about today's show. Inside Douglas County is a public affairs presentation of Brook Communications. Stay connected with local news and information. News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.